everybody. Welcome to the Rule of Three with Tim Slagle and Brian Miller. I'm Tim Slagle.
And I'm Brian Miller.
I did that on purpose.
Yeah, I know that.
And here we are back with a new podcast episode. We got a couple of segments coming up. In the final segment, by the way, we will be talking about the film The Martian. So if you haven't seen The Martian yet and you're spoiler averse, there's going to be a little hot Martian talk, a little hot Damon talk. But first, here in the first segment, we're going to be talking about Uber. Tim has a blog post about Uber, but I'll say up top, I don't use Uber. I've never used Uber. It's not out of any philosophical or sociological reasoning. It's that I'm very socially awkward and I don't do well with strangers. And I feel like if I call Uber, I really have to talk to the guy. Like, to me, you know, when they asked Charlie Sheen about why he had all the prostitutes when he had the Heidi Fleiss diaries, and they said, Charlie, you're rich and famous, why do you pay the prostitutes? You could have sex with anybody. And he says, I don't pay the women to have sex, I pay them to go away. And that's how I've always felt about cab drivers. It's like, I'm actually not even paying you so much for the ride as I'm paying you not to talk to me in any capacity. And people complain about cab drivers not speaking English, and to me, that's the best thing about cab drivers. I wish fewer people in the service industry spoke English, so I could just kind of quietly go about my day with my head down the way I kind of like to. But I feel like with the Uber thing, it's like, it's ride sharing, man. Or on Lyft, it got the funny mustache on the front. And I just feel like you're a jerk if you don't inevitably engage the guy in whatever godforsaken babble he's going to ask you to indulge in. At that point, I'd rather just walk. But what are your thoughts on Uber there, Tim?
You know, you might have a point there because most Uber drivers right now, it's what they want to talk about is how you should be an Uber driver, too.
Oh, is this like one of those things where if you sign people up to sell seeds or water filters or makeup and then they get a kickback or something?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pyramid scheme. That's what it is.
It's kind of cultish. I mean, it always had a little bit of like a Hare Krishna mobile thing, you know, like Shriners meet Hare Krishna.
Yeah, well, at least though, it is not it's not a Scientology cabs. So
they'll have those pretty soon, though, right? That'll be a thing.
That would be much worse. But you should be an Uber driver too. It's like, hey, idiot, do you think if I had a car, I would have called you?
And that's what bums me up, by the way. Yeah, it's like it's 2015. Here, I thought we might be colonizing Mars yet, and the economy might be better, and yet our greatest dream is that we could all be cab drivers.
Well, you know, I'm on the other side. I think it's great. I think it is perfect. It is the perfect American formula. I mean, you've got a car, you've got some free time, you need some cash. There are people that have some cash and need a ride. And here there is now the ability to just open your phone, turn on your phone, and the transaction is complete. It could not be more painless than that. It's with a cab, you don't know how long you got to wait there. And then if you call a cab, the same thing, especially, you know, good luck getting a cab. I don't know who gets a cab on New Year's Eve.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we know from working plenty of New Year's gigs, there's always a ton of stragglers at the bar who really want to go home, but they're all in that awful cab line.
Yeah, it's. I would like to find the person who actually got the cab. I mean, you assume
someone had to get it, right?
You assume that they're busy, but who got it? How did it? I think actually that on New Year's Eve, the cab drivers just say, you know, the phone's just going to ring off the hook. People are just going to wait outside the bar anyway. Let's just park them all.
What if instead of this being our big night, it's our night off? That's our choice. Because would know, right? You know, everyone just assumes that they're, well, they must be awfully busy.
Yeah, no, they're at home. They're saying, no, I am not. I spent one New Year's Day mopping vomit out of cabs. I refuse to ever do that again.
Would be the worst day to be, you know, being a cabbie on New Year's, I guess, is a little bit like being a comic on New Year's. You know you're going to get paid more, but it's not going to be a great day at work.
You're going to get paid more because you're going to need it.
Yes, you're going to absolutely feel like you deserve it. And speaking of which, I'll be in Templeton, Iowa this New Year's Eve with Jamie Blanchard. If you're in Templeton, Iowa and need some comedy laughs, this doesn't apply to you. It's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, it's I think actually the cab driver on New Year's Eve feels a lot like the prostitute that gets a call from Stephen Hawking.
It's like, you had no other choice. I mean, you know, and I do agree with you on Uber, by the way. I mean, it really is the practicality of it is really nifty, and the technological capability of it is great, and all of that. Like I said, I realize, like, the rational part of my brain realizes it's a good service, but I also just can't do it. I just can't do it.
No, I don't. I guess that kind of makes sense. But, you know, for me, I like it. And
I think I'm asking someone for a favor. That's what it is.
It is now actually the largest cab company. I actually saw some figures. It is $5 billion, I think, is what it's valued at right now.
Wow.
The company, yeah, which is roughly the cost of a New York cab medallion.
Yeah, I was going to say the second highest valued cab company was valued at $72.15.
But here's the thing. It's putting cab drivers out of work and all over the world. It's not just here in this country. I mean, there's a strike, I think, in Chicago today. The cab drivers are going on strike to protest Uber, which makes a whole lot of sense.
I was going to say,
it's we're so mad at Uber that we're going to spend a day making you all take Uber.
Yeah, absolutely. That seems like an Uber conspiracy. Maybe they're not even going on strike, and Uber's just telling people they are. You know what's great is I guarantee you a bunch of these cabbies are like, great, and they go get their own personal car, and they just drive for Uber on their time off.
I've actually bumped into a few.
Yeah,
that actually do is that that's their that they can't get enough. They can't get enough prime time hours. So yeah, so they do both.
Oh, but, I don't know. That's what it is. I feel like I'm asking a favor. Like I don't feel like the cab driver is doing me a favor. I kind of like that they're sort of standoffish with you usually. You know, they're always talking out. They're always in the middle of a cell phone call in a language you've never heard of, and that's just bliss to me. That's music to my ears. It's like if you've ever been in a movie theater and the people behind you are talking through the movie, but like they're speaking in Spanish. It's perfect. It doesn't bother me at all. There's nothing to get distracted by.
Really?
No, that never bothers me at all. It's English. If I understand the words, I'm
you know.
Bothered.
No, if I'm in a movie, and the people behind me are speaking Spanish, it's gonna annoy me like I got sat by the kitchen in a restaurant.
I have a thing when my wife and I go to a nice restaurant. It's this gag that she doesn't even. Well, she thinks it's kind of funny, but she can't admit it. I always put a single dollar bill in my hand. And when I walk up to get seated, I give the waiter the heavy handshake, but with the $1 bill, and I say, if you can, maybe something near the bathrooms. I don't know why, but that's the funniest thing in the world to me. I never get tired of it.
Yeah. It's funny to me, too, because I'm not sitting at the table with you.
Right.
And B, I'm not the host. who actually got a dollar?
I always try to look as like high class and like I'm really asking for a great table.
Oh no! I get it. I get the entire joke.
Yeah, it feels good. I enjoy it. But yeah, like I said, I don't know. It's the favorite thing. But you're right about Uber. Also, what else? Any take on Uber? Anything else to say?
Yeah,
about
well,
Uber?
That's yeah. My biggest point is that now they're asked that certain people are saying that the government needs to regulate Uber. That it's just the consumer protections aren't there, and to me that cracks me up. You know, it's because you know because the cab industry is highly regulated, and because there might be things like creepy drivers, dilapidated cabs.
Right.
You know, it's seriously, what does the regulation prevent other than city council shutting down your cab?
One of the last times I called a cab company, it was a very frigid day, and my car was broken down. And the cab that showed up, when I got into it, I realized was not a cab. I mean, I'd called a real cab company, but the guy must have passed me over to his brother-in-law or something. And we just I just drove in some regular dude's regular car with no meter to the newspaper office. And then he just turns to me, and he just kind of shrugs and he goes, "How about $10?" So that's the regulated cab industry. So I don't know how much Uber's going to make a difference.
And that's segment one of The Rule of Three.
Yeah, I'm Brian Miller.
I'm Tim Slagle.
We'll see you next time.
It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night. A lady up ahead waved to flag me down. She got in at the light.
Welcome back to The Rule of Three. I'm Brian Miller, and I'm here with Tim Slagle.
Yeah, I'm...
That's you. I stole your line, huh?
Well, yeah, I'm reading the article for the...
Yes, Tim found a very interesting article, and he sent it my way, and so we thought we'd talk about that. So I thought I'd... let's kick it over to Tim. What you reading?
Well, the headline of the article is Psychic Robot System Guesses Intentions from Your Movements. If we're to have artificial intelligence assisting us in driving, working, and walking around, it will need to understand not just what we're doing, but what we mean to do. Researchers at the University of Illinois Chicago have created a system that does just that, albeit on a limited scale. By carefully watching the motion of a person's arms, the system determines what the intention of that arm is. To pick up an object, for example. It just occurred to me because inside every man is a 12-year-old boy. is the intentions of an arm are much easier to.
Well, this is great. You could have some robots go on autopilot for you while you get to take a hit off your rum and coke or whatever, if that's your inclination.
Yeah, but anyway, what they're doing is they're coming up with algorithms that can figure out what you're going to do. In This has been something that I've been thinking about for a while, is that we all think that we're random creatures. We all think that everything we do has never been done before, and that at any time we can choose to alter and choose to change our behavior. And the older I get, the more I realize that we're not. That we're completely rote creatures, that everything we do is predictable. For instance, when I go to the grocery store, every time I go to the grocery store, I have to buy a bag of peanuts sitting right there by the counter. I've been looking at food for the past hour. I'm hungry now. I want a bag of peanuts for the ride home. And I've found that the last peanut from that bag is usually gone right before I cross the railroad tracks. Almost the exact same position every single time.
Like, you have a rate at which you eat peanuts, let's say, and that rate is pretty non-variable.
Absolutely non-variable. From the time I opened to put the car in drive to the time the peanuts are gone, it's the exact same distance every time. Weird, huh?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Well, first, I had a thought that I realized, technically, this is a big breakthrough, because I think this might be the breakthrough that helps us understand women. Because these robots know... not what necessarily you seem to be doing, but what you mean to do. And so I could maybe strap this onto my head and use like VR goggles, and I would just know what my wife meant all the time, and then I could respond accordingly. I think that's the real application of this technology.
Well, I hate to say it, but women do something that's more predictable than the last peanut. And what's amazing about that one, mm-hmm. is that we're usually more in tune to it than they are.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree with that one.
It's we usually know exactly what it is, but it's Voldemort.
Well, yeah, my thing is never the attitudinal problem. It's more the it's the nookie cycle. You know, you're like, oh man, we're coming into lean days. But, you know, this is great. I agree with you, actually, about the mechanical thing. And it actually, not to get too heady, but I was a philosophy minor at DePaul, and I just sort of was an amateur interest in philosophy. I always thought it was interesting. And I had this great teacher named Rick Lee, who used to be a stand-up comic, and now he's a philosophy professor, and he writes articles and books there at DePaul. And he didn't believe in free will, but more in a kind of mechanized way. He sort of believed, kind of like you said, that we were all essentially pattern-based. And it was sort of the pseudo Eastern idea that you're really, every choice that you make, you're not really making it so much. It's just the sum total of all the things that have happened to you thus far, sort of directing you like a part of a river. You know, you're just sort of riding through this current, and you think you're making a choice, but in fact, there was never a choice. All the things that happened before made it inevitable that you're just going to choose that thing, which is only going to lead to the next choice. And so ultimately, everything is kind of a mechanized march. It's just so complex, you don't necessarily see the pattern. So it feels like there's randomness.
Fascinating. I wanted a Marlboro kayak.
Oh, like with the Marlboro Bucks?
With the Marlboro Bucks, yeah.
Oh, I remember the Marlboro Bucks. My ex-stepmother used to have a friggin' nest of them on the trailer, the Formica kitchen table of the trailer. It looked like some sort of cigarette monster was building a lair.
Yeah, it was the gear is called Adventure Team. And
because nothing like smoking 900 packs of Marlboro cigarettes, you know, nothing like that to make you want to run outside and exercise and adventure.
Exactly. But it's funny to me because I still bump it into the house, things I use every day that are still Adventure Team. I got so much stuff because as a comic, you know, that's what I would do in between shows. I would go through the trash and pick out all the Marlboro packs.
Oh, did you also smoke Marlboros yourself?
I briefly, but the majority of the time was after I quit.
Oh, interesting. You were just privy to more packs than the average smoker because people left them behind.
Exactly, and I had a friend that had that actually owned a bar, and he'd save them all for me.
Oh, man, I bet that was a treasure trove.
Oh gosh, yeah, it was doing great. But he sold the bar, and
how many Marlboro bucks did he sell the bar for? That's a lot of Marlboro bucks.
And I started moving more into private gigs rather than the club gigs.
Sure.
And I still wanted that kayak. So I did what every ingenious Marlboro adventurer would do. You know, I'm not smoking, I'm not clubbing, I'm not and my buddy doesn't have the bar. What do? I walk the ditches.
Ah.
Was able to get the kayak, by the way. The story has a happy ending. But the interesting thing I found was exactly what we're talking about here, was you would find piles of trash that was very similar to the last peanut. For instance, there was one spot where there was a bunch of empty packs, and it wasn't a popular brand. It wasn't Marlboro. You know, there's no Miles there for me. It was like Territon or something like that. It was something like that that's really not a common brand. And there were there was a pile of packs there. And what I realized that probably was a person that smoked 19 cigarettes every day and then save number 20 for the morning.
Oh, sure.
And every single morning they would smoke the last cigarette they had and throw the pack out the window.
That was their last peanut.
Yep. Yep. That was their last peanut. And then in another place in the ditch, there was a stack of half pints of rum.
Same brand?
Yeah, same brand. Well, yeah, pretty much the same thing. So yeah, so essentially it was the exact distance from the liquor store. And I always thought that quite likely that he had to have it finished before he turned into the subdivision.
Oh, I was gonna. Yeah, that's probably what it is. Is you know, or maybe even with the cigarette packs. Maybe it's I keep these in my car and I finish them off and I can't throw them away in the trash at my house.
Yeah, but that's what I thought until the last peanut theory.
Yeah. Well, either way, he's still throwing them in the same spot. You know, it's still the same timing. It's still the same pattern.
Same exact stop sign. And especially, you know, in both of these people, I mean, they're drinkers and smokers. So drinkers and smokers think of themselves. I mean, that's why the Marlboro Adventure Team was so compelling. Because when you're a smoker and a drinker, you think that you're wild and you're crazy and you're random and you're not.
Yeah, it does have the tinge of individualism and ruggedness to it, or that was the that was certainly the marketing pitch.
Nope, but you're not.
No, just, no. In fact, nothing makes you more regular, no pun intended, than a cigarette. I mean, smokers inherently become, you know, in college during my brief foray into smoking, you know, college style, not really smoking, but when I would smoke on occasion, it would always be at the same times, you know, I mean, all the smokers were locked into their patterns. It was like, all right, between these classes, I've got time for this amount of, you know, I have a cigarette here. And so, yeah, it's really mechanizing you more than anything else.
And speaking of timing, I think we're out.
Yeah, may the robots will know when you want a cigarette and when our segments are over.
I'm Tim Slagle. You can look me up, skip the W's. I keep doing that. Well, Cubs
throwback. I love it.
Cubs won last night. So.
Yes.
So, timslagle.com.
And I'm Brian Miller, and you can find me at brianmiller.com, Brian with a Y. And we'll see you back for the next segment.
Why don't you just shut up?
Welcome back to the Rule of Three. I'm Brian Miller.
And Tim Slagle over here.
And we're back for the third segment of today's podcast. We're talking about The Martian with Matt Damon, based on the book, by the way, by Andy Weir. Did you read the book, Tim?
I did not read the book. I did not even know there was a book.
Yeah, the book was the guy who wrote the book. It's an interesting book because he's a scientist who worked on this book for many years. And it's more about the science. I mean, he does a pretty good job for a guy who's essentially not a professional writer of, you know, the story and the humor. And a lot of the dialogue in the movie is verbatim from the book. But the book delves more into the science because that was clearly what he was interested in. You know, it was like science porn. And, it was like 50 Shades of Grey with science. And it was like, all right, we'll have the people talk for a minute so I can tell you how to make dirt on Mars. And it's all chemicals. And I really liked the scientific enthusiasm of it, which I thought carried over nicely into the movie.
Yeah. No, it was it was very interesting to actually see a movie about space that was actually real.
Yeah.
That didn't involve wormholes or laser cannons or warp drive or any of those other things that we've become accustomed to that I think a lot of people don't even realize are impossible.
Sure. You're right. There were very few space movies that were non-sci-fi based. I mean, Gravity, Apollo 13, this.
Gravity even got a little ridiculous.
Yes, I agree. Although at least it was, it was sort of heightened reality, shall we say. But it's surprising. The right stuff. It was kind of a space movie, more about really flight than space.
Well, but those were all documentaries. This one was complete fiction.
Yeah, and interesting.
And it's interesting that it's that because. That people somewhat recognize that this one is actually real, so much so that I've actually seen that a lot of people think it's a historic, that it's a docudrama.
It's like, where were you when the first Jurassic Park opened? I think I was. I mean, I guess I can see why, in that it does, you know, they're definitely leaning toward some verisimilitude. I appreciate that, and I'm sure. I don't know, Neil deGrasse Tyson loves to do that thing where he nitpicks the hell out of movies, which drives me crazy.
That's what I had planned to do. So,
oh yeah,
I am gonna Neil deGrasse you to death on this one.
All right, we'll be a Neil deGrasse hole here, and
it's
as a liberal arts major, I'm unencumbered by the burdens of scientific knowledge.
There were a couple things. Number one is I found it really interesting that when he decided to make soil, that he went and dug out all the dried poop packets.
Right.
That were all labeled according to the astronaut.
Right.
And I said, there is no way that they're actually going to dry poop and store it in envelopes with your name on it.
Yeah, I didn't understand why their names were on it.
But actually, I read an article in Popular Mechanics, and according to Ridley Scott, yes, they do.
Just in case there's a smelt it, dealt it situation?
It's something, you know, I guess, I don't know. I guess they have to have a place in NASA where they send employees to punish them or something. But apparently, yeah, they analyze each astronaut's, so they have to take them home with them.
Oh, interesting. It's like the campsite rule.
And it came in really handy, for Matt Damon.
Yes, it did.
Because, you know, you could actually sort through those envelopes and you wouldn't have to touch anyone else's.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's gross enough to begin with, but, you know, but someone else's, you know, at least you know it's yours.
Yeah, no, that would definitely help. That would help slightly. Slightly. I did a little peering through my slatted fingers on that scene. I'm kind of easily grossed out in movies.
Here's one thing that bothered me, though.
Mm-hmm.
What were they doing on Mars?
Yeah, they weren't really doing enough. They were just, like, taking samples and whatnot.
Of what?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like the stuff they were taking samples. Well, I guess we've never brought back that kind of stuff, have we? I mean, our rovers can look at it and analyze it there, but we can't bring it back. I guess they were supposed to.
I thought, yeah, you're right. It's the getting them off the planet was... It would be, but you know, but the thing is, it's dirt.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you're going to spend that much money and that much time, that much resources just to have guys going through dirt?
I agree with you, and I don't remember there being a broader mission in the book. I guess if you know, I don't know if you were a big Marvel Comics reader back in the day, but Marvel Comics had a thing called No Prize. And if you found a continuity error and you wrote it in, you were supposed to include your made-up explanation as to why this actually makes sense, and you would win a no prize. It was a big sign of honor.
Huh.
So my Mighty Marvel no prize for this would be to say they did have greater plans, but as they said, the mission was fairly early on, and they had to scrub it. They were supposed to be there for many more days, so maybe this was their fairly early on first sort of explorations out.
This is number three. And they're sending a botanist, okay?
Right.
Okay. So let me get this straight. So they have a several month long mission. They've sent a botanist. Wouldn't he have been trying to grow stuff?
Yeah, you would have thought that would have been part of the plan in the first place.
Yeah, I know. They've got a greenhouse there. They've got a botanist. It seems to me he should have had at least a couple seeds with him.
That's an interesting point.
That was my other. And then the other one. The other one, and this one just really cracked me up. He digs a 1992 satellite out of the dirt and just plugs it in to the whatever that is, the 2020 computer.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
it just plugs right in. Come on. If you've got something from 2006, good luck finding a port on a modern computer that you can plug it into.
You can't even plug an American hairdryer into an English wall socket.
Much less 1992. Good God, you couldn't even find a, you couldn't even, 1992, you couldn't even get a SCSI connection that would go into that.
That's true. Now, here's the sort of things I noticed is because I'm not a science guy, I was just noticing, like, I love that their spacesuits, I think, were based on the spacesuits from Planet of the Vampires, which is one of my very favorite. They were for real. I have a poster on my wall, one of my all-time favorite movie poster images. You should Google it. It's the Italian poster for Planet of the Vampires, which is in the Italian title, it's Terror Despacio, I think. It's a really great Italian horror movie from the 70s.
Which sounds like something I would love ordering.
Yeah, ooh, the Territorio Despacio. It's terrifying, but so spatially. But yeah, the spacesuits in that were really singular and really cool, like Italian, back when the Italian fashion basically designed. And I thought the Martian spacesuits reminded me of that. The reason I like the Martian so much, and this will make me sound like an old guy, but... The more I watch movies and the older I get, I kind of get tired of movies always hinging on violence. Not because I'm a wuss, but just because it's such easy conflict. you know, every American movie always has to, well, someone's got to get a gun at some point, because it's just such an easy way to heighten the tension. And I was
I don't remember so many fight scenes in the original Hobbit.
Exactly. And so I really like when a movie, like Social Network, for instance, feels like a really intense movie, but there's no physical conflict. I mean, it just takes more interesting writing to generate intensity of conflict without taking it to the physical right away.
Writing? You want writing?
Yeah, that's my thing. I know that The Martian was well written as a story. I thought it had nice beats to it. That's a thing that could really potentially be very boring. And I thought old charismatic Matt Damon and the pacing of the movie really kept it flowing and kept it compelling.
It's it was for me. It was a real interesting take on the desert island.
Yeah, or kind of Jeremiah genre. Johnson and on Mars kind of almost.
Yeah, and rather than the volleyball, he had his video screen he could talk to.
Yeah, it was Castaway on Mars. That's true. It was which another movie I enjoyed. So, well, yeah. Speaking of The Martian, I guess it's time for me to bug on out somewhere else here. We're at the end of the segment.
Yeah, it's once more timslagle.com.
BrianMiller.com, Brian Miller with a Y, and at BMillerComedy on Twitter if you are a Twitterer.
See you next week.
See you guys next week.